The court has sentenced the leader of a Palestinian armed group to 30 years in prison. Ahmed Sadat, who leads the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, was found guilty of a number of attacks. Earlier, he had been acquitted of planning the assassination of an Israeli cabinet minister in 2001. Two other members of the PFLP received long prison sentences for the killing, which happened shortly after Mr. Sadat became leader of the group. A senior Palestinian official, Saeb Erekat, denounced the court's decision, pointing out that Mr. Sadat was a member of the Palestinian parliament. In her traditional Christmas message to Britain and the Commonwealth, Queen Elizabeth has acknowledged concerns about the global economy and violence around the world. She said Christmas was a time for celebration, but that this year it would be a more sombre occasion for many. The message included a tribute to Britain's armed forces. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Jamie Angus, and this is Europe Today, with all today's European news and developments from around the world. One of Britain's greatest playwrights, Harold Pinter, has died. He was 78 and had been having treatment for cancer. Harold Pinter excelled as an actor, screenplay writer and director, but it was his groundbreaking plays which made the biggest impact, so much so that the adjective Pinteresque even merited an entry in the Oxford English Dictionary. In later life, he became a vocal campaigner for political causes and was an outspoken critic of the Iraq War and of what he perceived as American imperialism. In October 2005, he was named the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Vincent Dowd looks back at his life.
Harold Pinter once listed the movies he'd loved growing up in London in the 1940s. At a film club in Hackney, the working-class district where he lived, he enjoyed Buñuel and Eisenstein, but, he said, he also loved American pictures like The Oxbow Incident, a Western he thought wonderful when he was 14 or 15. Significantly, the story's about mob rule, power abused and justice denied.
There can't be any such thing as civilization unless people have a conscience. If people touch God anywhere, where is it except through their conscience? And what is anybody's conscience except a little piece of the conscience of all men that ever lived?
Harold Pinter's fury at injustice and oppression was to dominate his writing until the day he died. This is The Birthday Party, his first full-length play, staged when he was 28.
Where is your lechery leading you?
Pay for this.
You stuff yourself with dry toast.
Contaminate womankind.
Why don't you pay the rent?
Mother defiler.
Why do you pick your nose?
I demand justice.
What's your trade?
What about Harlem?
What's your trade?
I'll play the piano!
How many fingers do you use?
Some sought clues to his lifelong rage for justice in his Jewish childhood. In 2002, Pinter said he'd come from a very stable and conventional Jewish family. There was an early sign of political engagement. At 18, he became a conscientious objector, refusing his military service. By the time The Birthday Party was staged in 1958, he'd been an actor for 7 years as David Barron. In 1956, he'd married the actress Vivian Merchant, and now he wanted to write. But the play flopped.
It ran for 6 days in London. And the Thursday matinee, there were six people in the audience. So that was not a very encouraging beginning.
Drama critic Matt Wolfe.
He takes something that looks deeply conventional, a boarding house setting by the sea, and turns it into this terrain of suppressed and then quite overtly realized violence. And that's shocking. He absolutely transformed what theatre could do.
The change in my life came with my next play called The Caretaker. And that was a big success.
I think it's about time you found somewhere else. I don't think we're hitting it off.
Find somewhere else?
Yeah.
Me? You talking to me?
It was clear Pinter had an absolute mastery of tone and language.
Not me, man. You.
What?
You better find somewhere else.
I live here.
The influence of movie dialogue was clear, short lines and few adjectives, and he'd learnt from cinema the potency of silence. But you hear echoes, too, of the ping-pong Noel Coward dialogue he'd known in Rep. Matt Wolfe says the big influence was Samuel Beckett.
And in fact, as Pinter's career continued, he became more and more minimalist, rather like Beckett, so the two of them ended at much the same place.
BBC producer Ned Shaye worked with Pinter several times, and radio remained a Pinter favourite. Why does Harold Pinter work so brilliantly on radio?
Because it is musical, and of course radio is a musical medium. Radio comes out of silence.
and the plays of Harold Pinter come out of silence, go back into silence, and in between something happens that the brain comprehends.
This is Pinter the actor, opposite Michael Gambon in the radio version of his play Betrayal.
You thought I knew?
She said you didn't, but I didn't believe that. Anyway, I think I thought you knew. But you say you didn't.
She told you when?
Well, I found out. That's what happened. I told her that I'd found out, and then she confirmed the facts.
When?
Oh, a long time ago, Jerry.
It was a great sadness to Pinter that he became alienated from Daniel, his son, by Vivian Merchant. That marriage broke up, and in 1980 he married the writer Antonia Fraser. The writer and actor Andy de la Tour was directed by Pinter twice on stage, but they became friends in a different context.
In the mid-80s, Harold, like thousands of others, like myself, was very excited about what seemed to be happening in Nicaragua with the popular Sandinista Revolution, as it was called, and he went there to meet with people involved in the revolution and was inspired by what the Sandinista government was doing. He was inspired by the people involved, a government made up of former students and priests and poets. He became quickly very friendly with Ernesto Cardenal, who was Nicaragua's leading poet, who was also a government minister.
So was it his growing interest in Latin American politics which turned Pinter's thoughts to American failings?
Constantly and permanently. I mean, Harold was very often accused of being anti-American. It's not only inadequate, it's completely wrong. He was never anti-American, far from it. He was just vehemently opposed to American government policy, especially American government policy overseas.
In December 2005, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, worth over $1.25 million. He'd survived cancer of the esophagus, but he'd become too ill to travel to Stockholm to collect the prize. So he spoke, you might say performed, to camera in a London TV studio.
The crimes of the United States have been systematic, constant, vicious, remorseless, but very few people have actually talked about them. You have to hand it to America. It has exercised a quite clinical manipulation of power worldwide, while masquerading as a force for universal good.
There were people who thought Pinter dry and obscure, yet a century from now it will be impossible to discuss theatre in our time without discussing him. When the Nobel Prize was announced, the director Sir Peter Hall called him a great and original poet of the theatre. Early on, Harold Pinter had surveyed the long course of English drama and had realised that the best work for the stage is a form of poetry. And his published poetry shows that beyond the undoubted personal prickliness, the sometimes angry young man from Hackney had become a writer of genuine tenderness too. Pinter wrote It Is Here about his wife, Antonia Fraser.
What sound was that? I turn away into the shaking room. What was that sound that came in on the dark? What is this maze of light it leaves us in? What is the stance we take to turn away and then turn back? What did we hear? It was the breath we took when we first met. Listen. It is here.
The voice of Harold Pinter, ending that report from our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd. Well, the actor Kenneth Cranham was a long-time collaborator of Pinter's, and when I spoke to him earlier in the afternoon, I asked him about working with the playwright on the stage and the screen.
I was actually in a production of The Birthday Party on the television with Harold. He played Goldberg and I played Stanley. It was the last of those sort of television productions where the cameras were like Daleks, and it was like filming a stage production, so you would actually get quite a run on the dialogue. And it was wonderful to be in a Pinter with Pinter, because he was allowed to ad-lib. he put in a line, "What a lovely staircase," he said, which is only in our version, because there was a little sort of gap in the action.
It reminds us that he was a pretty impressive stage actor as well as a writer.
He was pretty impressive altogether. What I always felt about him was that whatever he was taken with, he went for. There was something of the Saturday Night Out about him. There was he was suited and booted, and he loved being involved with his plays. I mean, he would be around and he would sit and watch a run-through. And if you forgot your lines, he could prompt you without referring to the text.
It's worth remembering, isn't it, how revolutionary a change these plays were from what had gone before. When they first appeared, the early plays, they were a genuine shock for theatre-going audiences, weren't they?
Yes, they were, but I've always felt that he was fantastically entertaining. They had an exhibit at the New British Library. They had a case devoted to his writings, and it had the early drafts of Homecoming, and I was in Homecoming at the time, and they had changed so much. They'd been rewritten to the extent of, like, an American musical was rewritten on the road. He really put the work in. He really stripped his work down.
And a very funny playwright as well. That was where a lot of the humour came in that rewriting process, you
Absolutely.
Think?
Absolutely. His jokes were tremendous. I mean, in The Caretaker, where I played Aston, there's a bit where the tramp pulls a knife on Aston eventually, and Aston looks at the knife and says, "I don't think we're hitting it off." I used to get a laugh from the audience, which was just vast.
After that early writing period, latterly he became an intensely political writer, quite surprisingly in a way. What do you think drove that change in him, that he felt so strongly about political issues, about freedom of speech, about American power and how it was exercised, these kinds of things? Why did that change?
Well, I've recently been doing some J.B. Priestley postscripts. He got on after the news in the Second World War on Sunday nights, and he'd achieved the power for people to listen to his opinions. And I think if you get yourself in that position, then you try and use it. And I used to think that the things he said about politicians were a bit extreme. I don't now. I think he was absolutely on the nail.
The actor Kenneth Cranham. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Europe Today. It's 17:17 GMT. Later in the programme, a leading economic historian talks subprime mortgages, financial ruin and alchemy.
You would take subprime mortgages and somehow turn a part of the money coming from the mortgage payers into a AAA-rated security. Extraordinary. But, of course, like alchemy, you can't, in fact, turn lead into gold.
German Marines have been in action today as part of the international force protecting shipping off the coast of Somalia from piracy there. A group of pirates were captured and then freed. Well, joining me now live is Commander Achim Winkler, spokesman for Operation Atalanta, the European Union's military operation off the coast of Somalia. He's speaking to us from Germany. Commander, what can you tell us about today's operation?
Well, good evening. Well, this morning, 8 o'clock, which was 11 o'clock local time, there the Egyptian bulk carrier Wadi al-Arab got attacked by some pirates and sent an emergency message. This unit was not registered with the Atalanta Maritime Security Center. However, the German frigate, which was in vicinity, sent the helicopter, which found the unit being attacked. The helicopter fired some warning shots, which made the pirates abandon from the attack. And six of the pirates were detained, but later on set free again. And one more detail, one of the crew members of the bulk carrier got injured by a shot from the pirates. He was picked up by the German frigate, and intention is to bring him to hospital in Salalah in Oman. That's it, what's known at that stage from that incident this morning.
And do we know why the pirates were set free after they'd been captured? That seems quite curious.
Well, yes and no. That's a difficult question. This is just a thing, detention of pirates, that's the one side of, or the one page of the book. And the other thing is to put them to jurisdiction. That always is national business. And in this case, they were detained by a German ship, but Germany will only bring them to justice in case German interests would have been hurt. A German ship might have been attacked, or German citizens might have been injured or even killed. That was not the case. And for that very simple reason, they had to be set free again.
That's a bit of a weakness in the EU military operation defending shipping there, isn't it? It looks likely that this kind of thing should happen again. We would want these pirates to be kept in captivity and charged.
Well, that's a bit difficult for me to comment on that. That, of course, is a thing of politics, to get those things clear. The the soldiers, the naval soldiers in the operation area, of course, can only deal with what they've got.
Now, this EU operation off the coast of Somalia, it began on the 8th of December, I understand, and would it be right to say this is the first time that they've successfully defended a vessel in an operation of this kind?
A unit from the Atalanta mission, yes, as far as I know, you're right. However, there have been incidents before which have been successfully countered by other units. There are a lot of other maritime vessels in the area not belonging to the Atalanta mission.
And it's interesting that German troops are involved. I think historically German troops haven't taken part in active service outside Germany, but recently in Afghanistan and now here they are playing an increasing role.
Well, yes, that's right. In this case, yes, you're absolutely right. The mandate is as robust as it never has been before. That's right, yes.
OK. Commander Achim Winkler speaking to us from Germany. Thanks very much indeed. Now, Christmas Day is traditionally a time for the world's religious leaders and heads of state to issue a seasonal message. In his traditional Christmas message this year, Pope Benedict has called for peace in the Middle East and in Africa. Speaking to worshippers at St. Peter's Square in the Vatican, the Pope called for solidarity in the face of an ever more uncertain future. He said that if people looked only to their own interests, the world would fall apart. He urged Middle Eastern leaders to use dialogue instead of violence.
La luce divina di Betlemme si diffonda in terra santa.
May the divine light of Bethlehem radiate throughout the Holy Land, where the horizon seems once again bleak for Israelis and Palestinians. May it spread throughout Lebanon, Iraq, and the whole Middle East. May it bring forth rich fruit from the efforts of all those who, rather than resigning themselves to the twisted logic of conflict and violence, prefer instead the path of dialogue and negotiation.
In her traditional Christmas message to Britain and the Commonwealth, Queen Elizabeth acknowledged concerns about the global economy and violence around the world.
Christmas is a time for celebration. But this year, it is a more sombre occasion for many. Some of those things which could once have been taken for granted suddenly seem less certain and naturally give rise to feelings of insecurity. People are touched by events which have their roots far across the world, whether it is the global economy or violence in a distant land, the effects can be keenly felt at home.
And that was Queen Elizabeth speaking this afternoon. Well, here in Britain, the TV network Channel 4 traditionally airs an alternative Queen's message and selects a different provocative personality each year. This year, they've been criticised for asking the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, for his message. And here's a bit of what he had to say.
If Christ were on earth today, undoubtedly he would fight against the unjust policies of prevailing global economic and political systems, as he did in his lifetime.
Well, Channel 4 said it had asked President Ahmadinejad to record the message because it wanted to provide an insight into an alternative worldview. According to the text of the message, Mr. Ahmadinejad says most of the world's troubles stem from leaders who've turned away from religion. A spokesman for the Israeli embassy in London, Lior Ben-Dor, told the BBC it is unfortunate, as he put it, that Channel 4 let the Iranian leader speak unchallenged.
Ahmadinejad is a danger, is a threat to the world, not just to Israel. And yet Channel 4 enabled him to speak and to bamboozle us all. We know how to send this message of our disappointment of what Channel 4 is doing. We know how to do it. The message will be sent to Channel 4.
And the UK government joined the criticism, saying that this invitation will cause offence and bemusement not just at home, but amongst friendly countries abroad. Well, what would you like to hear in a Christmas message from your world leader? Let us know. The email address is worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. That's worldhaveyoursay, all one word, at bbc.com. For 15 years, diplomatic relations between Turkey and Armenia have been frozen and their border closed. But there have been the first tentative signs of a thaw in recent months, including the first ever visit of a Turkish president to Armenia. Now there's even talk the border might reopen, all welcome news for local traders and politicians. But one group is watching developments with concern. That's the bird watchers. as Sarah Rainsford found out after an early wake-up call not far from the border.
You're in the marsh?
Yeah, we discovered a marsh. We went down to Kemp for the day.
It's 5:30 in the morning. It's pitch dark, and I'm driving to a lake in northeastern Turkey with a couple of bird watchers.
It's marsh warbler there.
Glenn's here, all the way from England. He can enthuse about birds non-stop. So what can you see this morning?
Lots of black-necked grebe, ruddy-shelled duck.
How does what you can see here compare to what you'd see in England?
Very impressive. I mean, here it's just literally wall-to-wall birds. It's sort of almost a case of where to start.
This remote lake that so impressed Glenn is a key site for migrating birds. They rest and refuel here en route from Eastern Europe to Africa. Almost 200 species have been spotted, including 14 that are globally endangered. Like this one. It's the sound of the ruddy shell duck. Very rare in Europe in the wild. But here, there are thousands.
See, this is cut. It's cut. And in fact, I mean, we tested this.
Protecting this bird paradise is a constant struggle, though.
See the reeds? Look, this side and that side.
Chan Şekercioğlu shows me a fence his conservation team built on a section of the shore. They wanted to let the reeds grow back inside and make a zone for birds to rest and to breed in. But local farmers didn't get it. They cut the wire and let their cattle in to feed. Overgrazing creates big problems for the birds, and now there's a new threat looming. It's just 30 kilometres from here to Armenia, but the border has long been closed. Now there are serious moves to restore official relations and reopen the crossing. Dr. Şekercioğlu fears tourists and truckers would then flood through here, driving the wildlife away.
These birds are sensitive to disturbance. You approach within 100 metres, they all take off. And if that keeps happening, these birds are migrating. I mean, they need a lot of energy. They have to go through storms. They have to cross Sahara. They are flying thousands of kilometers. So anytime they take off, they are wasting energy, and that increases the chance of their dying during the migration.
Almost 60% of Turkey's wetlands have disappeared in the last 50 years. That's made preserving Kuyucuk Lake for the thousands of birds that use it all the more urgent.
Right, that was Sarah Rainsford reporting. Back to our earlier story on Christmas messages. We asked you to tell us what you'd like to hear world leaders say as they address their citizens and subjects this Christmas, and specifically about the Queen's traditional Christmas speech in Britain. Elizabeth from Hamburg has emailed us to say, as an Anglophile German, I would be devastated if the Queen's speech was scrapped. There's nothing outdated about it. Many of us on the continent would love to have a royal family and all its fine traditions. That's Elizabeth. I don't know if she's any relation to the Queen, but anyway, she's emailed us from Hamburg. Just to remember, if you'd like to get in touch with us, the email address here is worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. That's worldhaveyoursay, all one word, at bbc.com. Or if you'd rather, you can send us an SMS message via your mobile phone, and the number for that is 44786 206080. That's 44786 206080.
The BBC World Service in the United States is distributed by Public Radio International. Distribution is made possible in part by the Medtronic Foundation, supporting the health of people and communities through grant-making, employee giving, and volunteerism. The Medtronic Foundation, on the web at medtronic.com.
WILL programs are made possible by English Hedgerow, offering gourmet foods and fresh flowers with a different accent. English Hedgerow also offers coordinated catering and decoration for weddings, parties, and corporate events. English Hedgerow, on the corner of University and Lincoln Avenue, Urbana.
You're listening to the BBC. I'm Jamie Angus, and this is Europe Today with news and comment from Europe and around the world. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll look back at the historical roots of the world economic crisis and ask who'll recover from it first. Professor Neil Ferguson and economist George Magnus will be our guides. As part of our series on Christmas cookery from around the world, we'll be eating pastries in the Holy Land. But first, a summary of the latest news.
BBC News with Eileen McHugh. One of the 20th century's greatest and most influential playwrights, the British Nobel Prize winner Harold Pinter, has died, aged 78. Although an excellent actor and director, it was Harold Pinter's groundbreaking plays, such as The Birthday Party and The Caretaker, which made the biggest impact. And the adjective Pinteresque even merited an entry in the Oxford English Dictionary. The German Navy says it has apprehended and disarmed six pirates who tried to hijack an Egyptian cargo ship off the coast of Somalia. A Navy spokesman said the pirates had then been allowed to go free on orders from Berlin. The deposed Prime Minister of the West African state of Guinea, Ahmed Tidiane Souare, has said that he and his government are at the disposal of the junta, which seized power earlier this week. He was speaking after following orders to report to an army camp in the capital, Conakry. The Israeli leaders have issued their strongest warning so far to the Palestinian group Hamas to stop firing rockets to Israel. The Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, said that he would not hesitate to strike Hamas and another militant group, Islamic Jihad, in the Gaza Strip. In her traditional Christmas message to Britain and the Commonwealth, Queen Elizabeth has acknowledged concerns about the global economy and violence around the world. Her message included a tribute to Britain's armed forces and made special mention of families who have to spend the day apart. She also praised her eldest son and heir, Prince Charles, who celebrated his 60th birthday in November. A court in Egypt has sentenced a school teacher to 6 years in prison for beating a pupil to death because he didn't do his homework. The boy later died in hospital. The court was told that he had four broken ribs. And police in Los Angeles are looking for a gunman dressed up as Santa Claus who burst into a Christmas Eve party and opened fire on the guests. The house subsequently caught fire and three bodies were later found. BBC News.
BBC World Service. This is Europe Today with news and comment from across Europe and around the world. It's been a terrible year for the world's great financial centres here in Europe and beyond. The impact of the global economic crisis affecting the financial markets and banking sectors has already seen thousands of workers lose their jobs, with many more to follow in the new year. So would it be fair to say that the atmosphere in the City of London, Britain's financial centre, is more muted than normal? Well, the city is barely a mile here from us at Bush House, so I met up with George Magnus, the Senior Economic Advisor for UBS Investment Bank and a 20-year veteran in the City of London. We went for a walk about just behind London's Liverpool Street station, near the centre of the city's financial area.
We're on the Broadgate Circle. It's a development in the city which has been around for, I don't know, probably about 20, 25 years. The circle itself, actually, in the winter is an ice rink, and in the summer they have all sorts of events and concerts and exhibitions here. And it's surrounded by quite a lot of office buildings, relatively low-rise by skyscraper comparisons. Yeah, it's looking pretty festive now with lights in the trees and Christmas tree and so on.
It's looking pretty festive, but I guess it's not feeling very festive right now.
No, it's definitely not feeling festive. In fact, it's almost a little bit Dickensian, really. If we think about people wishing each other happy Christmas, and everybody knows it's not a very happy time, really. I think everybody is very used to the idea that the layoffs and redundancies in the city are actually probably as big as, or proceeding as rapidly as they have done in any time people can remember. But, you know, I think around here people's attitude is pretty philosophical, which is that, you know, it's high-risk occupations and, you know, when the axe falls, which it does every once in a while, you know, it falls pretty hard. But a lot of people are taking the opportunity, I think, to do different things, other things, if they can. And it's not all grim news, I would say, to the extent that people actually end up doing things that they're happy doing.
I guess for a lot of people who came into banking and associated financial professions in the last 7 or 8 years, they must have felt that this was a boom time that perhaps would never end.
I think that's a fair comment, actually. I suppose, if you came into the city within the last 10 or 15 years, age 20, 21, 23, 25, you've never seen a recession, you don't know what a downturn really looks like. I think probably it is much more shocking for younger people for that very reason. I think for those of us with, you know, one or two grey hairs who've been around a little bit, seen this before, it's the worst that I can remember it. I mean, I've seen one or two downturns in the city before now and in the financial services industry, but this is pretty major. I don't think any of us have seen anything like this before, and it's going to go, the axe will fall, you know, very, very deeply, and I think the financial services industry will, I won't say will never be the same again, but it's not going to be the same again for a very, very long period of time. As we know, you know, during the 80s and the 90s and really up until 2006, 2007, with occasional reverses and short-term problems along the way, I mean, that whole 20, 25-year period was one very, very long boom. So it's in the nature of business cycles and of financial cycles that people, you know, have to become accustomed to the idea that nothing goes on forever. This one actually did last an awfully long time, so it's now finished.
Right. Every trip to the city must contain a short visit to a city watering hole, so I'm going to ask you to take me somewhere and we'll find something to drink.
Right you are.
When we spoke earlier, George, you alluded to a sense of optimism, bizarrely, in the city, and you said there was a sense that while things were bad at the moment, they would get better in the future.
One of the things that I was trying to refer to was the way in which people who are being forced out of the financial services industry or actually reconsidering their futures actually are going back to, or thinking about doing things which perhaps we haven't done enough of in the past. So one of my kind of little mantras is that the rocket scientists are going back to making rockets, which is just a really a short form for arguing that people with very, very finely honed skills in whether it's mathematics or in computing or engineering or in different sorts of, you know, social and physical sciences are actually either moving out of the city and going back to teaching or to doing, you know, working in commercial companies or manufacturing companies or setting themselves up as entrepreneurs. And I think this is part of the big churn that takes place at times of great and momentous change, which is very disturbing, very distressing whilst it's going on, but actually it's not such a bad thing in the scheme of things, and that's really what I was referring to.
The effects of the global economic crisis are very variable around the world. Who do you think is going to be hardest hit in the next couple of years, and actually who will escape the most unscathed?
There's no question that the hardest hit places are going to be those countries that basically have endured not just the banking crisis, which applies to most countries in the West, but also the housing downturn. And, of course, in the United States and the United Kingdom, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, to name but a handful of countries, also some in Eastern Europe, I mean, the housing bust has been particularly severe. And because of the significance of housing and housing wealth in the confidence of the consuming sector, that's where I think it's that the shakeout and the recovery process will be longest, because I think the housing booms and busts never travel in sort of short cycles. They always take, it's very biblical, you know, it's usually 7 or so years of feast and 5 to 7 years of famine. So these will be the most difficult issues for those countries to address. Countries that haven't had the housing bust, which would include countries like France and Germany, Europe would include most of the countries of Latin America and most countries in Asia, in fact. I mean, one would imagine that these countries should get to the bottom of their downturns or their recessions much earlier. So maybe by the summer or the, you know, third or fourth quarters of 2009, I would imagine that these countries may have reached the bottom. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be suddenly expanding at a rate of at a light speed after that. But I think that gradually, I think this thing will come to an end, probably paced by those countries like Germany in Europe and China in Asia, which have not had the housing bust, which will last a long time.
So, as we sit here at Christmas, we shouldn't despair completely.
Well, I think we should never despair, and I think obviously, you know, in the Western world, Christmas is obviously a time for hope. So I'm not trying to underestimate or trying to dismiss the severity of the crisis, but I think we are approaching it in a way which I think gives me reason to believe that we're not going to have another Great Depression, and that, you know, over the next 3 or 4 years, we'll gradually come out of it. And not all countries will be as badly affected as we've made clear.
That was economist George Magnus, author of The Age of Aging, looking ahead to the future of the financial world in the year to come. So how did we get so far into this financial bubble? And do the lessons of history have anything to teach us about how to get out of the predicament we're now in? My colleague Claire Balderson has been speaking to Professor Neil Ferguson. He's Professor of History at Harvard and author of several books on the economy, including most recently The Ascent of Money. So why do all bubbles eventually burst?
Well, they always burst because there comes a point at which the euphoria that has driven the bubble up to its maximum point shifts into doubt. And that doubt is usually based on the fact that the price of the shares has reached a point that can no longer be justified on the basis of any possible realistic measure of future earnings. So there's a psychological shift. With the euphoria phase, people believe irrational things about future earnings. When distress sets in, they begin to doubt this. And when panic sets in, that's when the price of the shares goes into freefall. There's a mass rush for the exits. One of the interesting things about bubbles is that there's usually an insider group and an outsider group. The insiders know when to sell. They probably are the people who know the reality about the company. They may even be consciously defrauding the public. The outsiders are the people who've never bought shares before and come in fairly late in the bubble thinking, this is extraordinary. We're missing out on a huge profit opportunity. Let's buy these shares. They can only keep going up. And they're the suckers who get left with nothing.
Are there then parallels with what we've seen in the subprime mortgage crisis, which is essentially around a housing bubble, isn't it?
The subprime story is a slightly different story because it hasn't really been focused around the stock market. It's been focused around the real estate market. It has been based on easy money. There is a good parallel. It really couldn't have happened if it hadn't been so easy to borrow money, if in effect the Federal Reserve hadn't let credit conditions become too easy. But what was going on in the housing bubble was that people began to believe their own houses would just carry on appreciating in value. And since they had roughly doubled in price in a remarkably short space of time, this began to become somewhat dubious as a position. Once house price inflation reached 20% a year, you'd reached the point of simple incredulity. And once people began to ask questions about those condos in Arizona, can this really be worth what we just paid for it? The bubble had reached its maximum point.
Why weren't those questions being asked earlier, though? Why hadn't people learned from history? Because you just have to look back. In every century, there is a point at which people think they're onto a good thing. They think they're making lots of money, be it in houses or the stock market or whatever, and it turns out something goes horribly wrong. We don't seem to learn as human beings from what went before.
One reason for this is the phenomenon of securitization. After the breakup of the savings and loan system, financing housing in the United States changed profoundly. It was possible to sell or to make a mortgage loan and then sell that loan almost immediately to a financial institution, a bank, that would then take a whole bunch of mortgages, bundle them together, and then slice them up into tranches, and then sell these as so-called collateralized debt obligations that the rating agencies were willing to say were AAA rated, as good as gold. And this was a kind of financial alchemy. You would take subprime mortgages and somehow turn a part of the money coming from the mortgage payers into a AAA rated security. Extraordinary. But of course, like alchemy, you can't, in fact, turn lead into gold.
That was Claire Balderson talking to Professor Neil Ferguson. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is Europe Today. The time is 17:43 GMT. Now, a reminder of our top story today, the Nobel Prize-winning British playwright, actor and political activist Harold Pinter has died. His friend, the actor Kenneth Cranham, told me that working with him was a lot of fun.
It was wonderful to be in a Pinter with Pinter because he was allowed to ad lib. he put in a line, "What a lovely staircase," he said, which is only in our version because there was a little sort of gap in the action.
And one other headline today, the German Navy says that on orders from Berlin, it's allowed to go free some pirates who it prevented from seizing a ship off the Somali coast. 2008 was an eventful year in China. It brought the country's worst natural disaster in 30 years, the Sichuan earthquake in May. followed by the most important event modern China has ever held, the Olympic Games. Just a few weeks later, the country was shaken by the scandal of poisoned baby milk. After the upsets and triumphs, the year is now ending with real concerns about the effects of the global financial crisis on the country. Our China correspondent, James Reynolds, reports.
I encourage you to bid strongly tonight. We'll take cash, we'll take credit card, but I tell you what, we do not take, Lehman Brothers shares. We do not want those here tonight. All right?
You get the message then. Hard times may be coming to China, but there is still one bunch of people more than happy to spend. Hundreds of Beijing's richest people gather for a fashion show and charity auction organized by the Versace Fashion House.
Last chance, 15万, fair warning, sold 150,000. Thank you.
So, has the world's financial crisis put these people off their bidding and buying? Li Tong works in communications. She spends about $3,000 a month on luxury brands. That's as much as many Chinese earn in a year. As she thought about perhaps cutting down a little bit.
A little. But luxury brands are having massive discounts. A lot of them are on sale, and so you feel like you're losing even more by not buying.
Xiao Ge is another Versace fan. She works in the art industry. Is she thinking of cutting back?
Yes, I will cut back spending on big-ticket items, like investing in property or buying a car. But I will still spend on small forms of entertainment, like going out to eat, buying clothing. So it is still the same.
But outside the fashion house, the financial crisis has begun to worry China. This country's growth has been driven by its exports to the rest of the world. So if the West can no longer afford to buy, then China won't be able to sell. Thousands of factories in the south of the country have already closed down. The government has cut interest rates and announced a $586 billion stimulus package designed to keep the economy going. Professor Liu Jin is an economist at the Chung Kong Graduate School of Business in Beijing.
I think the Chinese people should be very worried about the future because this is one of the largest financial crises we have ever experienced in the last 100 years. So the last one would be the Great Depression. Yeah.
And this is going to affect China in what way?
In several ways. One of the things is that there's a global drop in demand so that the Chinese exports, you know, cannot sell. And there's another one, which is the effect on investments and sentiments, because now everybody's worried, and I think that sentiment is already in China, too.
Just a few months ago, everything sounded a lot more optimistic. On the evening of the 8th of August, fireworks marked the start of the Olympic Games in Beijing. Despite fears of bombs, protests and pollution, the Games were a success. China won more golds than any other country. And inside the Bird's Nest Stadium, the athletics events were dominated by a lanky young sprinter from Jamaica, Usain Bolt.
I've said this so many times, but it's not even close! It's the third world record! Another world record for Jamaica, 5 miles again! Usain Bolt completes his masterpiece.
Months later, at the end of the year, China's Olympic venues are still full of visitors. The Olympic Sailing Center here in the coast of China at Qingdao has become a pretty popular place for people to come and get their pictures taken. There's a group of military officers standing all around me at the moment. They're standing having their pictures taken in front of flags. They're posing in front of the boats. And they're all looking out towards the Pacific Ocean. Zhang Feng lines up to have his picture taken in front of the Chinese flag flying outside the venue.
Many people who haven't come to China,
Through the Olympics, a lot of people who haven't been to China or Qingdao now know us. We will tell the world that our Qingdao, our country China, is the best.
And it's this view into the Pacific Ocean which may define where China goes in 2009. On the horizon, you can see cargo ships making their way through the sea. The more ships there are, the more business China's doing, the better the economy will be. The world is waiting to see how the financial crisis hits the world's fastest-growing economy. You may be able to find the answer by counting the ships on the horizon.
Right, now, with details of what's coming up on the World Have Your Say programme straight after us, we're joined by Roz Atkins. And Roz, normally at this point you'd be sitting opposite me, but you're not. Where are you?
I'm actually in Tunbridge Wells, which is a town about an hour or so south of London. For practical reasons, it proved a lot easier to bring you World Have Your Say from here at BBC Radio Kent than from Bush House. But
and these, honest, are these are Christmas-related reasons, are they?
These are Christmas-related reasons. I've even got my editor, Tom, who's sitting through the glass here wearing a Christmas jumper, which he's just been given. So
happy Christmas to you both.
Thank you very much, although we're not going to be talking about Christmas, but that is the reason that we're here.
Tell us what's coming up on the programme today, Ross.
OK. Well, today we've handed the agenda over to 8 young people from Bangladesh, America, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Greece and Kenya. They've got together and decided that they would like to talk with people all around the world listening on the BBC about direct action and whether it offers the best way for them to get their opinions heard and taken into account. Lots of people say, well, hold on, look at the rates of voting in the under 30s. Maybe people should vote before they start looking at taking direct action. They say, we don't believe that even if we do vote one way or the other, politicians take any notice. So we're going to be looking at that issue. If you're listening and would like to take part, do post your comment and number at worldhaveyoursay.com. We may read out your comment on the air, but we're not going to read out your phone number, don't worry.
OK, Roz, and do you want to give out the email and the phone number as well?
Sure, it's country code 44 20 70 83 72 72, or you can email us now, worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com.
Roz Atkins, thanks very much indeed for joining us, and you're coming up right after this programme. You're listening to The World Service. It's 17:51 hours, and I'm Jamie Angus. All this week, we're hearing about the food people around the world will be eating to mark Christmas Day and the festive season. Well, December the 25th is the date on which most Christians celebrate the birth of Jesus. The New Testament Gospels tell how he was born in Bethlehem in what is now the West Bank. Palestinian Christians may well be sitting down today to a meal of stuffed chicken and rice or roast lamb, but many will also be making and eating date-filled pastries known as mamoul. Our reporter Hugh Williams has been to meet one family who live in a little village just outside Bethlehem, which has its own special place in the Christian story.
You join me in Bet Sahur, which, according to tradition, is where the shepherds were watching their flocks by night when the angels appeared to tell them about the birth of Jesus. Shepherd's Field actually is about 100 metres from the home of Georgette and George Rushmawi, mother and son, who are going to cook a traditional date. Well, it's kind of a cookie, kind of a cake. And, Georgette, you've already begun preparation work. Tell me what ingredients you've prepared.
I prepared 1 kilogram of semolina. I add 1 cup of vegetables fat and half the cup of vegetables oil. I mix all together.
So you've made a sort of a, well, it's like a crust. It's not quite a pastry, but it's quite a soft mix, which you're rubbing between your fingers.
Yeah, to make it smooth in my finger. So I will add now the yeast.
Just to make it rise when you cook it?
Yeah, yes.
So how much yeast are you putting in?
Yeah, 1 spoonful.
Okay.
1 spoon sugar.
To activate it and make it work?
Yeah, to make it.
And then I guess a little water?
Yeah, hot water.
So we stir that up?
Yeah.
George, whilst your mum carries on making the pastries here, it strikes me that of all places to celebrate Christmas, this must be the most extraordinary place. To have literally the shepherd's field 100 metres from your house, and up the road the church, which marks the place where Jesus was born.
Indeed. You know, I am from Bethlehem myself, and I am from Bet Sahur. Sometimes from my porch,
I go and look at towards the shepherd's field and I try to imagine with my mind and try to see the angels 2,000 years ago spread the message of peace. And, you know, what an amazing thing to be in a place where, and this special place in the Shepherd's Field is actually where I spent my childhood in.
And is the yeast ready to go in or not quite yet?
Yeah, yeah.
The yeast can go in?
Yeah, yeah.
So pouring in the yeast and sugar mixture?
Yeah.
In another bowl on the table, Georgette has a date paste she's made as the filling for the cookies.
I took dry dates, but half of a cup of vegetables oil, and then I put
cinnamon.
Cinnamon, or 1 spoon.
So you've got the tub of cinnamon here, which, if we take the lid off just to smell the cinnamon, to be honest, that smells like Christmas to me.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the idea is to make the dates as a filling.
Yeah.
And make the outside of the cookie or the cake with the dough that you're kneading together.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this is a very traditional, not specifically Christian cake to have, but very traditional for Palestinians.
It's a very Palestinian. It's to make ma'mul. Ma'mul is made at all religious seasons here. We make it at Easter, we make it at Christmas, we make it at Eid al-Adha that we just passed a couple of weeks ago.
So for Muslims as well as for Christians?
Muslims and Christians. We Palestinian Christians. We are Christians by faith. We are Muslims by culture. And we might have Jewish blood, we don't know.
So when we filled two big baking trays with my messy attempts and Georgette's perfect ma'mul, they go into the oven and the family settles down to listen to some seasonal music. Just under 15 minutes later, the house is filled with a delicious smell and the ma'mul are cooked.
We must wait a little bit.
I can't wait. I wanted to see what they taste like.
The taste is very good. It's tasty.
I'm going to have a taste. I'm sorry. I know they should cool a bit more, but I'm going to have a taste. Yeah. It is quite hot. But it's such a nice taste.
Really?
The dates are so good. Oh, that's good.
And sweet.
Yeah.
You made it.
Georgette, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Merry Christmas to you and to all the world. And we told them Merry Christmas.
That was Hugh Williams reporting from just outside Bethlehem. Today, Christmas Day. Well, earlier in the programme, we were asking you for your emails about Christmas messages. Just a reminder that today, a BBC TV station, rather, in the UK, is screening a seasonal message from President Ahmadinejad in Iran instead of the traditional seasonal message from the Queen. And it's interesting that those of you listening outside the UK seem more sympathetic to the Queen than people listening in Britain. We've had an email from Yaroslav in Russia, who says, "The Queen's speech is a traditional symbol of Christmas celebration. Thank you, Your Majesty." Well, in contrast, Pat from Brighton says, rather than reminding everyone how bad last year was, I wish she, the Queen, would make a speech about the future. I think the alternative speech on Channel 4 with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will be far more interesting. Well, if you'd like to join that debate, you can email us. The email address is worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. And just a reminder that on the top story of the day, that's the announcement of the death of the playwright Harold Pinter, major European literary figure. You can get more information on that on the BBC News website, which is bbcnews.com, and they have full coverage, an obituary of Harold Pinter, and even a clip of him performing in The Birthday Party, one of his most famous plays. Well, from all of us here at World Service, happy Christmas to you all, and goodbye.
This is Jay Unger.
And Molly Mason inviting you to tune in to The Pleasures of Winter, an hour of live music celebrating the winter holiday season.
You'll hear fiddle tunes, vintage jazz, beautiful waltzes, sweet harmony singing.
And some original songs all about the season.
The Pleasures of Winter on PRI.
Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Prospect Bank, coming soon at the corner of Prospect and Kirby in Champaign. Dick O'Neill and the team at Prospect Bank are committed to providing Champaign-Urbana with a fresh perspective on banking. Information at theprospectbank.com. Member FDIC. Prospect Bank is a division of Edgar County Bank and Trust.
You're listening to WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from CarX Auto Services.